This program is brought to you by Threes Brewing, a Brooklyn-based brewery making beers you'll want to revisit over and over again, carefully crafted and gladly shared. Visit Threes at 333 Douglas Street in Gowanus, or learn more at threesbrewing.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Welcome to Feast Your Ears. I'm Harry Rosenblum from the Brooklyn Kitchen, a cooking store located at 100 Frost Street in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. Join me every Wednesday as I talk with people about what they do and how it influences their personal food stories. This is a show about people, life, and food. Today's episode number 68, Feast Your Ears. And this one is not just about people, life, and food. It's also about airplanes and flying. I'm happy to have Chris Wolmer on the line today. And Chris is an on-call pilot, and so he could get whisked away at any moment to go and fly somewhere. So thanks, Chris, for taking time out of your on-call day to join me.
My pleasure, Aaron.
So, Chris, can you introduce yourself and talk a little bit about what that means to be on call as a pilot?
Yeah, sure can. I guess as you said, the most interesting part of it is not knowing what's happening next. So,
right,
you could get called at any time. I do have set days off each month, 12 days off a month. The other days, I'm at the company's beck and call.
And is that 24/7? Like your phone could ring at 3 a.m. and they say, we need you to come and fly somewhere?
Well, it does change day to day what time we're on call.
I see.
But it's a 10-hour period. So, on a given day, like let's say today I started at 9, which means I'll be finished by 7. So if they don't call me by then I'm free to go.
Got it. So you have it must be a really interesting way that you end up scheduling your life, so you can do some things like this radio interview right in the middle of the day,
but you
could get a call or a text while we're speaking, and they could say you have to show up at the airport. Now you fly for JetBlue, correct?
That is correct. Yeah, and the other thing I would add is there's a minimum of 2 hours notice they can give you. So
got it.
I do have a little bit of time to. You know, get myself together, put the uniform on, and head out to the airport. So you can do things near the house. I've gone as far as out to the Rockaways, to the beach while I was on call. And
well, that puts you pretty close to JFK, right?
Yeah. yeah, it's close to JFK. And, if I get called, I just go grab the car and go to the airport, put the uniform on, and go to work.
So. Right, right.
You have a little bit of freedom on your on-call day.
Cool. How long have you been a pilot?
20 years now. So since I was 24 for the airlines, and I actually first got my private pilot license all the way back when I was 18, which was in, 1990.
Wow. So you've seen, I imagine you've seen a lot of changes in the industry. Starting your career before September 11th, 2001, and then going beyond that?
Sure, yeah. 9/11 took a lot of, obviously it took people by surprise,
sure.
And it just really changed kind of the attitude. The biggest change that we saw was a lot of times some of the smaller aircraft didn't even have a cockpit door, and on the bigger aircraft, oftentimes we would just leave it open, or
right.
If you had an interested child on the flight, they might come up and you might show them around a little bit during the flight, and that's strictly against policy anymore. That door stays locked,
right? Until the end of the flight, right? Usually, I mean, I feel like I sometimes see the pilot sort of with the door open at the end of the flight if I'm getting off a commercial flight.
Absolutely, before and after, we're more than happy to have people come up and say hello and do a little tour of the cockpit if they want, but it has to be before or after we push back from the gate or
right.
arrive back at the gate.
Right.
Yeah.
So as pilots, then, are you stuck there? I mean, the door is effectively locked.
Yeah, essentially we are. You know, we'll come out and take a bathroom break on some of the longer flights.
I was going to ask about that.
And when we do that, we'll always have a flight attendant. We'll come up to the cockpit while one of us goes back, and that's specifically a U.S. procedure. I know you probably remember an accident in Europe where one of the pilots went out to go to the bathroom, and the other pilot essentially locked him out.
Yep.
And that led to an accident. So their policies are changing over there, but that's always been a U.S. policy since we installed the doors.
Got it. And so when you started training to be a pilot, I mean, was that something that you knew you wanted to do as a kid? I mean, did you have your sights set on being a commercial airline pilot for a career?
Yeah, I did. I guess I had a very common story for pilots where my father was a pilot.
I see.
And got me interested in it pretty early on. He didn't work for the airlines. He was always in general aviation. But I had done a few flights with him as a kid, and he let me, mess around in the controls a little bit more and more as I got older, and I got more interested in it. And I went to school down at the University of Illinois, I started in the aviation program down there and started to build my time and get all my ratings.
And so now, I mean, so the ratings, as I understand it, have to do with what jets you are allowed to fly. Is that right? Like, you know, size wise and engine configuration and that kind of thing.
There's certain the basic ratings. So you get your private pilot rating, which just allows you to fly around and maybe take up friends for sightseeing flights, things like that. And then you work up towards instrument rating and commercial ratings, which then allow you to fly in inclement weather, and the commercial allows you to fly people for hire, and that kind of segues into other ratings that you get and specific ratings for the airplanes, as you're talking about. So right now I fly an Airbus A320, which you go through about a month-long specific course to learn the airplane itself.
And how different are they between different, I mean, the two big manufacturers, right, are Airbus and Boeing.
Correct.
I mean, when I was a kid, you used to see like McDonnell Douglas, you know, MD-11s and stuff, or what, is that right? It's an MD-11. Mm-hmm. But I don't see those anymore. So are the airplanes very different to fly?
The specific manufacturers' airplanes are very similar, especially Airbus. Each aircraft they make, regardless of the size, they make the cockpits almost exactly the same.
Hmm.
Boeing, it depends on the model. Some of them are very different. The 737, because it came out so long ago, the cockpit is quite a bit different from one of their newer planes, say the 777 or the 787, the Dreamliner.
Got it.
Because there have been so many technological advancements.
Right.
So,
do you have a favorite aircraft to fly in the commercial fleet?
Yeah, interestingly enough, you were talking about airplanes and companies that don't exist anymore, and I was lucky enough to fly the Lockheed L-1011, and Lockheed is still making military aircraft. They're no longer making commercial aircraft, however. And that airplane was the biggest one that I've flown in different configurations. It held up to 325 people.
Oh, wow.
Looked very similar to a DC-10, if you don't remember the airplane. It had two engines, one under each, three engines total, one under each wing and one on the tail.
Yep.
Yeah.
And what was it, what is it specifically about that plane that you like as a pilot?
Good question. It was, interestingly, planes seem to have gotten, some of the planes have gotten slower over the years.
Huh.
This one was quite a bit faster than the Airbus that I fly now.
Oh, wow.
And it was almost over-engineered, you might say. It had so much redundancy in its systems and controls. It was just a real pleasure to fly. Not that airplanes aren't a pleasure to fly now. It's just this one for having come out in the 1970s was was very technologically advanced and beyond its time.
You mentioned, you mentioned the redundancies, and certainly the technology has really increased recently, or in recent decades. As a pilot, how much active work do you do in the cockpit? And I'm not, not saying that it isn't, that you're not doing work, but I mean, as far as actually physically flying the plane, is the plane flying by computer? Are you holding the yoke the whole flight?
Yeah, quite a bit of it is by computer, and we do have, I guess, the option to let the computer do as much as we like. Most pilots will fly the takeoff and the climb, and up to maybe 10,000 feet or so before we turn the autopilot on, and then we're still controlling the airplane, heading and altitude, climbs and descents, things like that through the autopilot. So you're still twisting dials, as it were. And then we usually take back over, maybe a couple thousand feet above the ground and fly the approach and landing. Although most modern aircraft now will do a landing all on their own
once you
set it up.
So,
yeah.
I mean, I guess that's similar technology that eventually we'll see self-driving cars, right?
Absolutely. Can't wait for the day. With airplanes, I hope that, of course, I have a job, but it's neat to see the technology come out where the computers can do more and more for you and hopefully eliminate some of the human error, which, we've eliminated a lot in the airline world, but certainly not on the roads.
Right. Absolutely. Do you have I've heard the sort of cross country or the big routes referred to as kind of like highways of the sky. Is that an accurate description of it? Like when you're flying a cross country route?
Yeah, it's actually changed a little bit over the years as GPS has taken more of a role. So we used to fly from ground-based navigational beacons. You would fly from one position to the next as you crisscross the country, and now there's more, we just call them direct routes. Mm. So you might be somewhere over Iowa flying out towards the West Coast, and they'll say, you can go direct to Las Vegas at this point, or something that would normally have been too far away to pick up a signal from a ground-based beacon.
Right.
Whereas as now using the GPS, it can, locate a position to within, 10 feet or so vertically and 10 feet or so laterally and fly direct to that position.
Sure. And
very accurate.
Yeah. And do you feel, you have a different perspective on flying from the cockpit than those of us who are sitting in the plane as passengers do. I often, spend some time looking out the window and you see other planes. Do you see more planes out the front? Like, are often on a flight, are you following right behind other planes in the same path?
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. Especially out over open water, if you're flying down to the Caribbean, say, or over to Europe. We do fly on specific routes. So the GPS navigation that I was talking about that we might use over land, we're still using the GPS to fly a certain track, but we're all flying over the same path going out over the water. And that's because there's, less VHF communication out over the water, and they want planes in certain specific places at specific times to keep track of everything and keep the separation, which I think you were probably getting at as well, which is vertical and horizontal,
right,
separate from other aircraft.
Right.
So.
Absolutely. Do you have a favorite or a least favorite route to fly?
That's a good question too. I'm always more interested by airports that kind of provide a little bit more difficulty. So maybe it's a shorter runway or there's mountainous terrain involved. It's always interesting flying out into the airports in the Mountain West. So Eagle Airport out in Vail, something like that, where it's a little more intense trying to avoid mountainous terrain and get the aircraft in safely.
Cool. We're gonna take a short break and hear from one of our sponsors here. And when we come back, we're gonna talk about food on airplanes.
All right.
Let me tell you now a story that your blood will chill.
And this one's called Hole in the Floor of the Plane by the Sparrows. We'll be right back.
Story of the day when I first met my greatest fear.
This episode is brought to you by Threes Brewing, a Brooklyn-based brewery known for creating drinkable craft beers that balance complexity and simplicity with a focus on lagers, farmhouse ales, and hop-forward American ales. Threes Brewing makes beer that's good, not just interesting or different. Beer that can be enjoyed without jostling for your attention. Beer that you'll want to revisit over and over again. The brewery itself, located at 333 Douglas Street at the intersection of Brooklyn's Borum Hill, Park Slope, and Gowanus neighborhoods, is a brew pub serving beers from the Threes portfolio and other top breweries, as well as cocktails and wine. While you're there, you can grab a sandwich from the Meat Hook or coffee from 9th Street Espresso. In the evenings, look for live music shows in Tiny Montgomery and a rotating series of DJs in the main bar. The brewery at Threes is a community space where friends can come together and strangers can become friends, or just drink Constant Disappointment IPA. Visit Threes Brewing at 333 Douglas Street in Brooklyn or their outpost in Greenpoint. Learn more at threesbrewing.com.
Welcome back to Feast Your Ears. I'm Harry Rosenblum, and today I have pilot Chris Wolmer on the phone. Chris, while we took the break, did you get a call? Do you have to go to the airport to fly today?
I did not, fortunately.
Okay. All right, so we can finish the interview. Good.
Yeah.
When you do get called to go on a flight, is it usually I always imagine that the job of a pilot, they say where the crew is based, right? So I feel like when I get off a plane on the West Coast and they say, you know, thank you for flying with us from your New York based crew, I always imagine that the crew is flying from New York to, say, San Francisco and then back in the, you know, and that that's sort of the route that they're flying. Is that how it works? Or do you end up, like, would you go to San Francisco and then get called to fly somewhere else from San Francisco and then to somewhere else before you end up home again?
It all depends. You might do a couple day long trip where you fly out to San Francisco and lay over in a hotel. And the next day you might fly up and down the West Coast, and on your way back to the East Coast the day after that. It can be 3, 4, 5 day trips at a time where you're on the road that entire time. And then there are days where they'll call and say you're flying down to, say, Miami and right back to New York, and then I'm finished for the day and get to sleep in my own bed at night.
Even though you've been to Miami and back.
Yeah, right. So a lot of travel in a day, but you're still home at night, which is my preference. I'd much rather be home than on the road.
Sure. So. When you have vacation time, do you like to fly places? Do you take the train? Do you drive? Do you hike?
I do, yeah. Travel's a passion for my wife and I, so we do quite a bit of traveling on our own time. We've taken some really great trips recently. We were out in Africa on safari for our honeymoon. We were in Hawaii for my birthday just a few months ago, and planning a trip out to Southeast Asia probably for this fall.
Oh, very cool.
A couple weeks out there, yeah.
If you make it to Japan, I definitely have some suggestions for you.
Excellent. Culinary suggestions, I imagine, right?
Of course. I mean, I have a lot, you know, there's a lot to see, of course, in Japan. But yes, I have plenty of culinary selection. So let's actually move on to culinary stuff. I feel like in recent years, at least the food that you are fed as a customer on planes has actually gotten a little bit better. I definitely feel like the 80s and 90s were kind of a very dark time in airline food. It seems to have gotten better. I was on a Delta flight recently, and, you know, the option was like a wrap or some cheese, and the cheese was actually from Murray's. So, like, you know, I was like, oh, that's kind of cool. It's, you know, a much better quality than I would have sort of expected. As a pilot, do you end up, you know, are you served the same food on the plane if you're hungry? Do you bring a lunch?
Oftentimes, I bring my own food. JetBlue is a little unique in that we have some of our aircraft that are configured with a first class cabin, and then the majority are not configured with that first class cabin. And so for the flights, and these are transcontinental flights, so out to LA and San Fran, like you were talking about before. Those aircraft have a first class for the longer mm-hmm. routes, and we do serve a lot of actually New York based food because we're a New York airline on those flights, and we are able to eat that same food that we serve the first class passengers, which is kind of a nice perk on those flights that we don't get on the majority of flights that we do.
Right. Right. Yeah. So, I mean, as a passenger, I often bring my own food as well. Do you have any sort of tips for listeners about good spots in airports? That's something else that I've noticed in my recent travel is that, I feel like, you know, it's great that we have things like Shake Shack showing up now at New York airports. However, you know, I don't always think that, you know, like a burger and fries is what I want to eat before I get on a cross country flight. Whereas, coming from the West Coast, if you're getting on a plane at LAX or at SFO, you know, they've got good salads available, food that I feel like is a little bit lighter and not exactly, you know, not going to feel like, you know, you're sitting for 6 hours with this like rock in your stomach.
Oh, sure. I agree with you there. It's the biggest difficulty that I face is eating healthy. And that's why I do try to bring my own food as much as I possibly can. And on a 4 or 5 day trip, it gets a little more difficult keeping that food fresh that you bring with you.
Right.
So, it's always a struggle to find something at the airport that's a little healthier. And there are more and more healthy options popping up. But for the most part, it's a burger or a slice of pizza. It can be difficult to keep things healthy, to keep things light. So,
what is your so if your phone was to ring right now and they were to be sending you on a route, which would and you know, what route could pop up on your phone that would make you most excited for a place to go eat?
To go eat.
Like if you were going somewhere and you had a layover, you know, and you knew you were going to have a layover for a night somewhere that you sometimes fly, what's your favorite place to go to? Because I feel like, you know, when I travel, and I would imagine when you and your wife travel, you know, where you're going to eat becomes a really important part of the event, and you, it seems to me, are in a unique position to get to do that a little more often than the rest of us on like a one-off basis. Like you'll end up somewhere for a night and be able to check out a restaurant. So do you have a favorite in some other city that if your phone rang right now, you'd be really excited about?
Sure. Yeah. And it's interesting living here in Brooklyn. I feel rather spoiled in my food choices.
Yeah, so we are.
I would almost rather do the flight that I was talking about earlier where I'm back in Brooklyn at night and I can eat here. This is still always my favorite place to be. But actually, and sometimes it's based on the hotel that we're staying at and what area we're
right,
in,
right.
And its proximity to restaurants, because we don't typically have transportation. So if you want to go eat at a restaurant that's an hour away, you're stuck paying for an Uber or a Lyft to get you that distance and back to the restaurant. So the layovers out in Los Angeles, we stay in Koreatown, and there's some excellent Korean barbecue options out there that I'm quite fond of.
Nice.
So that's one of my favorites. If they told me right now I was going to LA, I'd be pretty excited.
That would be what's for dinner, huh?
Nice. Yeah, exactly.
When you get on a plane in the way that you work as an on-call, do you often know the co-pilot and the flight attendants, or do you just get on blind? I mean, I have trouble understanding sort of how big an organization, for instance, JetBlue is.
Sure. Just to give you an idea, and we're JetBlue only has about 5% of the domestic market, so we're pretty small compared to the other airlines, United, American, Delta, Southwest, and so on. And with us controlling 5% of the market, we still have I believe about 3,500 pilots and over 5,000 flight attendants.
Got it.
So it's pretty big. And when I get on the plane, there are times where I'll know the other pilot that I'm flying with, or one or two or more of the flight attendants. But probably more frequently than not, I don't know anyone that I'm getting on the plane with. Which, you know, our procedures become very important because you're working with people you've never worked with before.
Right. Right, and so everybody's expected to perform the same job and know what everybody's going to do.
Correct. Yeah.
When you fly for pleasure, do you like to fly on your own airline, or is that weird?
No, I actually prefer it. I guess it's a shameless plug for JetBlue, but I do think we provide a good service and
sure.
Have comfortable seats and great snacks and whatnot. So yep. I do like to fly on my own airline. Unfortunately, sometimes you're going somewhere where your airline doesn't go, and yeah. we do have reciprocal agreements with the other airlines for sometimes free and sometimes discounted tickets to get back and forth to where you're going. So,
cool.
It's a very nice perk.
Yeah, yeah. It's definitely it's I had a family friend or a cousin of my dad's, I guess, who was a mechanic for a long time at Northwest. And so he, mm-hmm. He and his family always were able to, anytime someone had a birthday or an event or anything, they would show up because they could. It was pretty easy
sure.
for them to get
yeah.
on the flights.
It gives you a great flexibility. I have a few nieces and nephews, and I try to always make their birthday parties, even though they live in Chicago.
Right.
I have the ability to fly on jump on a plane last minute.
Yep.
So,
speaking of Chicago, Chicago is sort of your, hometown, I guess, right? And
that's correct. Yeah,
being from Chicago, but now living in Brooklyn, I have to ask: do you prefer a thin crust pizza or a deep dish pizza?
The question I knew was coming my way.
I figured.
I actually prefer thin crust pizza. Although I would say I prefer Chicago thin crust pizza to New York thin crust pizza, and I'm sure this local audience is ashamed of me for saying so.
Well, I hope that I have a national audience for Feast Your Ears. So,
right.
That's my hope anyway. Or even worldwide, hopefully. I do have a couple mm-hmm. of listeners. I do track it. I have a couple of listeners, like in the dozens in many, many countries around the world. So that's cool.
Excellent.
So any other Chicago, is there any Chicago food? I mean, obviously there are, people talk about hot dogs in Chicago. Are there any other Chicago foods that you feel like we don't really have in New York? I mean, there's obviously, I touched on pizza, which is like the big one, but.
Yeah, the hot dogs is an interesting one. Not that the hot dog itself is any different, but maybe the way we dress it in Chicago.
Yeah.
The thing that I haven't been able to find much outside of Chicago at all is the Italian beef sandwich, which I'm sure you're familiar with. A very delicious, specifically Chicago dish, which I actually had an air traffic controller one time as I was flying over Ohio ask me if I ever made my way through Ohio, because he knew we were coming from Chicago that day, if I would bring him an Italian beef sandwich. I, of course, said yes if I ever made it through that way.
Right. Oh, that's funny. So actually, that I hadn't thought about that. So do you have sort of like radio friendships with air traffic controllers who you've never met that you've spoken to for 20 years?
There are times where you recognize a certain voice.
Right.
Not much over kind of, as you're crisscrossing the country, but more a local controller. So.
Right.
There's a gentleman that worked at New York for a long time and retired about 5 years ago, and he had a very specific voice on the radio, and most of us knew him, although probably most of us never saw him
right.
in person.
Right.
It was somebody we always knew, and he had a kind of a unique way of signing off when he would switch you over to the departure controller, and he was working the tower or, just specifically the airport area. At JFK, he would say, good night, great flight.
Nice.
And, I kind of miss hearing his voice.
Yeah. Well, if he's listening, or if anyone who knows him is listening, that would be a fun interview. So you should email me.
Sure.
I have one last plane question, mm-hmm. which is about turbulence, which I would imagine a lot of people who meet you and find out you're a pilot ask you about.
Sure.
Is turbulence something that at this point you are so used to that it doesn't bother you at all?
Yeah, I would say that's pretty accurate. It's something that's not inherently dangerous to
right.
the aircraft at all. But it's one of those things that makes almost every passenger nervous.
Sure. I mean, I know
as soon as we get into turbulent air.
Yeah. I mean, cognitively, I know that it is not dangerous to the aircraft and that in fact, the aircraft is moving a minuscule amount, compared to what it feels like. And that
mm-hmm.
it's more akin to like, I was once described to me as it's more like driving down like a gravel road than it is like racing over a speed bump and jumping your car.
Sure, or driving a boat in real choppy waters.
Right.
All similar things.
Yeah.
The recommendation I always give to people who are specifically afraid of turbulence, or maybe more afraid than most people, there was a really great documentary made about the Boeing 777 that came out when the aircraft did, and you can still find that, I think, on Netflix or Amazon Movies, something along those lines. But it shows the stress test that they did when they first built the airplane to certify the wing. And they have it in the factory, and they show them bending the wings up to, I believe, almost a 70-degree angle without the wings suffering any damage at all. And it's both impressive and very reassuring to people who were, you know, look out and see that wing shaking up and down to realize that there is nothing that's gonna affect the structural integrity of that wing. So.
Right, right. Well, we're just about out of time. I wanted to ask, if you have any words of advice, anything that people who are flying should keep in mind to make it, to have a better flight for themselves or to make it a better flight for you and for the flight attendants.
Kind of a general question that nothing comes to mind. What were you thinking about?
Oh, I mean, I feel like when I see people getting on planes, one of the things that I'm always struck by, being someone who's old enough to remember when you could check a bag for free, is that the stress that people go through getting on an airplane seems insane to me. I mean, I had a guy, I was getting on a plane last week, and a guy pushed in front of me to get on the plane ahead of me. As if somehow I was going to take his seat, right? I mean, I guess for me, I always think about people should just relax. I mean, like, we're all going to be stuck in this little metal tube together for a number of hours anyway, and like pushing into each other and not treating each other with respect, and in a way that you just would never do. I find it just to be something people should remember more.
Yeah, I guess the best remedy for something like that is to tell people to get to the airport even a half hour or an hour earlier than they originally planned. And that way you have time to decompress a little bit, because it is a stressful environment, and it's unfortunate the way you see people treat each other in the airport and on the airplane.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thanks so much, Chris, for coming on the show today. I appreciate it. And, it seems like you only have a few more hours that you might get whisked away. So perhaps you get to have dinner in Brooklyn tonight.
Yeah, that would be my preference. I appreciate you having me on, Harry. I enjoyed the talk.
Thanks very much. Well, thank you, everybody, for listening to Feast Your Ears today. Big thank you to Kristen Baylor, my producer here at Feast Your Ears, and David Tatasciore for engineering. And a big thank you to JetBlue for not calling Chris and allowing him to be on today. But JetBlue is not a supporter of Heritage Radio yet. We'll see what we can do about that. You can find Feast Your Ears, as well as lots of other great shows, at heritageradionetwork.org and on iTunes. And you can shoot me an email at harry@thebrooklynkitchen.com if you have any questions or suggestions about the show. And if you like the show, please like it on iTunes, Stitcher, etc. And you can follow me on Instagram @thefoodballer. I'll talk to you next week. Thanks very much.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.